We're in the studio today with Dr. Warren Bell. Hi, Warren.
Hello.
Warren, how long have you been a doctor?
I graduated from the Faculty of Medicine at McGill University in 1974, completed my residency in 1976. So I would say 48 years is a pretty good estimate of how long I've been doctoring.
And what was it that made you decide to get into medicine?
Interesting story. My undergraduate degree was in music and creative writing. And I went to Toronto from Vancouver thinking of advancing my career in one or the other of those fields and discovered that I had done it all wrong. I should have gone to a small town and got my chops worked out, and then I could move on to the big city. And so my efforts were remarkably unsuccessful. I got a few part-time jobs, but none of them were particularly meaningful or satisfactory. So I went to the YMCA, and they had an advertisement for a complete assessment of your aptitudes and abilities so that you can figure out what kind of work you want to do. It was a three-day event. I filled out a whole bunch of different test forms and met a psychologist, had a chat or two. And at the end of it, one of the things that came up that I had never in my life considered was going into medicine. It said, you have the aptitudes for that kind of work. So because everything else I was doing wasn't going very well, I said, why not? Bought a book called How to Get into Medical School, followed the instructions, and I batted 333, which means I got in 2 out of 6 medical schools. Did 2 years in one at UBC, did the other 2 years at McGill, and then finished off with my residency there as well, and worked for 3 years in Montreal. My conception of things was that I would do medicine as a sort of a sideline, and then I would practice my musical and literary skills and interests as my main task or job or whatever employment. And of course, it worked about exactly opposite. I'm doing very full-time medical practice, have done for what they call full service family practice for about, of those 47 years, 48 years, about 40 of them. And the last 6 or 7 or 8 years, I've been slowly reducing my scope of practice. But all the other years I was, you know, attending childbirth, making home visits, working in the hospital, admitting patients, following them in the hospital, assisting at surgery, and of course, working my office 4 and a half out of 5 days a week for most of that time, and then being on call for emergency and working in emergency as well throughout most of those years. So that's my entertainment.
You mentioned you went to school in BC. Are you from BC?
Yeah, originally born and raised in Vancouver. Did my high school and an undergraduate degree in Vancouver. And then because I was accepted in 2 medical schools, I did a pre-med year at UBC. And then because I was accepted twice, I did the first 2 years at UBC. And McGill said, if you don't come for 3rd and 4th year, we'll terminate your application. So I'd never been to Montreal. I'd never been across the country to live. And Joanna was willing to give it a shot. So we moved and we ended up staying there for a total of 7 years, finished my training, started working in a palliative care service, the very first in the world in a hospital. So it was kind of a groundbreaking thing that I actually found very much to my taste. It was something that I felt really good about doing. And I worked at lots of other things. I worked in an emergency room in Montreal. I worked in long-term care. I did some psychotherapy. I had already started doing psychotherapy in my residency. I had an aptitude, and it was recognized by my mentors, and I ended up also working for a year in a psychiatric outpatient department, as well as all these other things. And then we moved back to BC and came to Salmon Arm after checking out a couple of other places that weren't all that great. And that was at a time when parents on both sides of our family were getting older and needed attention. So it was an important move for us to make.
How long have you been here?
Came here on July 1st. Well, my first work day was July 1st, 1979. I arrived a couple of days earlier, and then on the long Canada Day, long weekend, all of my colleagues in the clinic I had joined left town and said, you're in charge. It's all in you, up to you. I actually was so, it was quite an anxiety-provoking experience until I kind of got used to what was happening, and then I realized it wasn't all that bad. But thank God I'd been working in an emergency room in Montreal, and thank God I had a lot of helpful nurses. I actually think I delivered a baby, or I didn't deliver it, the mother did, and I was there. And if it wasn't for nurses, I would have been up the creek without a paddle, but they were very kind and supportive. And the process was written up in a book called, I think it's called The Secret Lives of Small Town Doctors, and I wrote a chapter in the book about my experience, and so did a number of colleagues, because it was by turns hilarious and overwhelming, but worked out okay in the end.
So have you always had your own practice then, or did you graduate from working within a clinic?
When I arrived, I worked with a clinic. The physician whose clinic, he kind of had set it up and built it and all the rest of it, had somebody moved away, so I took that person's place. And then after about 8 months, he took issue, ironically, with the way I had handled a patient who needed palliative care. And after working for 2 years in a world-class center where we had a pretty good idea what to do, I did what I would have done there, and he didn't like it. And he had a bit of a habit, which I only realized later was something he did to others besides me, of if he didn't like what you're doing, he gave you the heave-ho. And if people didn't like what they were doing, they took off. So there were at least four or five practitioners came into the same position I'd been in and left, mostly because he would object to something they did. He was a bit particular. Later on, years later, he said he thought it was a mistake to have tossed me out because I'd actually thrived despite that. And I wasn't afraid of working in my own office. Most doctors used to work in their own offices, and then it changed and are now gathered into groups, mostly for cost-saving purposes, but not because they collaborate particularly. Anyway, it worked out fine. I had my own office. I was part of a call group of about five people besides myself. And that, you know, was really helpful. There were amenable people, a physician, two pairs and one single out in Sorrento. And so we all took one night a week and then one weekend in six to cover for each other's patients. So that was what I did for probably 25 or 30 years.
And where was your office?
My office is in the Town Square building, which is right next door to the post office, upstairs at the back, 204, suite 204. And initially I was in the old Alcoholics Anonymous meeting room, which is directly across the street and above a bookstore. It is a bookstore now. The air conditioning system in the summer was totally inadequate. You'd basically cook unless you opened the windows, in which case you get the fumes from the corner of Ross Street and Hudson Avenue, or you kept them shut and you cooked. And in the winter, the heating was inadequate, so you had to stay close to the middle of the room because the periphery got pretty chilly. And so the guy who built the Town Square building is a Oklahoma oil magnate who'd moved to Salmon Arm, found out about it, wanted to live here so his kids could be raised in a safer town than most of the towns in the U.S. So Larry Jarnigan was his name. He came across the road. He'd heard about me for some reason and said, we'd like to move over here. I'll charge you the same rent that you pay here. And since the facilities I was in were inexpensive and miserable, it was a no-brainer. We moved across and I've been in the same office ever since, from about 81 till maybe 82 till the present day. So basically 42 years. The three owners who've cycled through the building. The original owner left town, Larry Jarnigan, and then somebody else took it over, and then somebody else took it over from him, and then now I think there's a fourth. But they probably valued me as a tenant because I was no trouble, and my patients didn't spit on the sidewalk or anything like that. They were fairly well-behaved, and they haven't actually raised my rent for a number of years because they've been pleased with my no-maintenance residency in their building.
I know you play the violin.
Indeed, I do.
And how long have you been playing?
I started when I was about 11 or 12. I didn't progress initially because my teacher wasn't very helpful, but then I had a much better teacher and I ended up getting up about to grade 8 conservatory level and then was off at UBC and distracted by other things. So I ended up not continuing my lessons, but I continued to play and I have continued to play up to this day. And I still do. Right now, I'm playing once a month with a very competent pianist here in town. We play a bunch of this and that, and some classical, some folk, lots of different stuff. But it's something that's always been part of my life. I probably have played at the wedding or funeral of every family member that went through one of those experiences, and for a few others as well, and actually picked up the guitar, which is not too hard to play after you play the violin. And so I play the guitar reasonably competently as well, and I've done that. And then I did a lot of singing over the years. My degree in music involves singing in choirs and small groups. Didn't play the violin at university. I studied off campus. But it's always been a part of my life. Music was there when I was a kid. My mother was crazy about opera, and my father was crazy about Baroque music. And in between, there were the Beatles and a few other groups that I was enamored of. So it's a current that flows through my days.
Do you have a favorite genre?
No, I like certain individual pieces. I mean, I love Yesterday. It's a brilliantly composed piece. You know, harmonically, it's interesting. The melody is wonderful. The words are terrific. I like certain classical pieces. We had Beethoven's Seventh Symphony on a long play disc at home. And I loved the second movement so much. It's a funeral march, but it's wonderfully written. And I probably played that record over about 150 times over the years because I liked it so much. And I like particular composers sort of thing. Schubert I like a lot, and some popular groups. I even like John Denver songs. I like a piece of music that has a melody that you can recognize, and even better if you can sing. Because while it's all very well to have, I mean, rap is great, but it's really basically poetry with a beat. And the melody is secondary. And from a musical point of view, I don't find that all that interesting, but I certainly like what people call lyrical, you know, music melodies. There's a tune written by a guy named Orlando di Lasso, who is a early Baroque composer who is probably Dutch, but he got his name translated to Italian. Orlandus di Lasso was the other way it's pronounced. And he wrote a melody in French that's Mon cœur se raccommande à vous, which means my heart is attached to you. And it's sort of a love song, but it's one of those love songs where the theme is, you don't care about me, so I'm just feeling miserable all the time, but I wish you did care more for me. And that's the gist of the words. But it's got a lovely melody. And because I can sing falsetto, I've sung all four parts, which is fun. And the other thing I should mention is that my wife, Joanna, is a talented songwriter and had a burst of songs that she wrote a few years ago, back in the 80s, actually. And I'm now singing several of them, looking for places to sing them because they're about the state of the planet. And they're quite well written. The language is quite well thought through and articulate, and the melodies. I've worked a little bit on harmonies and rhythms and stuff like that on the songs, but they're really her work. I sang one at my first big public concert was a 400-person conference at UBC. And halfway through the second verse, some of the words slipped out of my mind, so I sang La La for a couple of words. Joanna was sitting about 10 rows back and right in front of me, and I just saw the expression on her face, and it was a magical moment. But anyway, I got back on track and sang the rest of it, and it was so well received that there was a Russian professor from a university program in Moscow who was there at this conference, which was a peace conference bringing American and Soviets together to talk about peace. And he loved it so much that the next morning we came down to the beginning of the conference, and there he was sitting at a piano, plunking it out with one finger on the piano. And eventually we got it translated into Russian with his help. We discovered that the word for peace and the word for earth is the same word, which is kind of a nice little coincidence.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, she's written some really nice songs and we've recorded them, but the recordings were done with very simple equipment, and we're re-recording a couple of them now, as you may be aware, and would like to distribute them more widely because they're very appropriate for our times. They're very much about either celebrating the natural world or regretting the harms we have done to the natural world.
And that brings me to some other nonprofits that you're involved with besides Voice of the Shoe Swap.
Yeah, I've had a long experience going back to when I was in Montreal, where I became involved with a group called Canadian Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. And then we started recycling. There were no recycling societies there, but if there had been, we would have joined them. We moved back to BC, and the CPPNW set of initials is actually part of my email address, which I had then when I was working as, well, when I was involved in the board of directors of the organization. And so my email address is CPP Bell. And that was precisely because of that connection. And I just haven't bothered to change it because I've got every spam artist in the country knows where I live. And but I've got a good spam program. So it's a saw-off, you might say. Yeah, and then here, involved with a group that started up in about 2009. One of the first things I did when I got here was set up an event called Global Health or something like that. It was just an event where all the healers that were around of every sort, I invited them all to come and do displays and do presentations. And it was just my new age guy thing coming into town, but it drew a fair number of people. And then in 2009, as I said, there was a big to-do because the city had endorsed a plan to build a large shopping center in the delta of the Salmon River. And a group of us came together very spontaneously, knowing that it was a very bad idea from an environmental point of view. And we spent 4 years pushing back. And the end result was that we were able to reduce the footprint of the shopping center by about 60%. The only result that would have pleased me was to have stopped the shopping center being built there at all and built up on the east side of town where actually the population base mostly lives. But that didn't happen. So, and then there are lots of other organizations, the Shuswap Food Action Society. I've had some interactions with the Oxfam. I've supported a lot of groups like Inter Pares, which is a group that works with people in other countries on an equal basis, not as a donor and recipient basis, but on an equal basis. I've written a lot of articles for the National Observer, not for money, but just to get ideas out. I wrote for the local paper for 10 years. I had a column called Global Health. Other organizations like the Shuswap Food Action Society, the Shuswap Climate Action Society, and a bunch of others that I've supported over the years, probably about 15 organizations that I send regular contributions to and support when something's going on that's relevant, involves somewhat with the Green Party. Although I know that the way the electoral system's constructed, they'll never get anybody elected in his province. But on the other hand, I think they're on the right side of the angels and the future generations. So it seems like a natural thing to support. So lots of stuff, fairly busy.
So in the last few years, we all know we've had this problem with the world called a pandemic. How did that affect your business?
It didn't really change much. There were a few differences. I went and worked for a bit in a clinic that was set up specifically for people who wanted to know if they needed to worry about whatever was going on for them as to whether or not it was part of the COVID-19 pandemic or not. Most of the time it wasn't, but, you know, they were worried and they could come out of hours in the evening to see if anything was happening. I allowed people to make choices about what they thought they wanted to do. I would tell them what I think the evidence is. I think when it boils down to it, certainly the first two rounds of vaccines were probably beneficial. The numbers that you could see from the coroner's office, BC coroner's office, were pretty explicit. They had a significant effect on lowering sickness and hospitalizations and mortality. After that, I think the evidence for benefit has declined. And it's not so clear. And there is some evidence now that repeat vaccinations, not just with COVID vaccines, but also with influenza vaccines, may reduce immune capacity. There's some new evidence that the CDC is well aware of, the Center for Disease Control and Laboratory. They're concerned about it, but it hasn't reached through to change practices yet. And I think in any case, I've always been a bit of a pharmacoskeptic because I actually wrote a paper many years ago and it was published in 83 on a major publication that's used by doctors all over the country called the Compendium of Pharmaceuticals and Specialties. And the research that I did for this paper showed that it was really an advertising vehicle for the pharmaceutical industry and not a source of reliable information. It's improved, but it's still something that you buy your way into. So it's something that you use for the product you want to promote and you ignore for the old cheap stuff that you don't want to have people buy, you want them to buy the new expensive stuff. It took me 8 years to get this paper published, and I learned a heck of a lot about the drug industry that I would say the average physician isn't really aware of, maybe a bit more aware of now, but by and large, the chicanery that goes on within the pharmaceutical industry is dimly understood and not always responded to, especially in the specialist community, which is quite tightly linked to the drug industry. Family physicians tend to be a little more skeptical because they deal more with the whole person and they deal with people over time. So it's easier to see that the proposed remedy isn't working all that well or is causing problems. Whereas a specialist just prescribes and says, this will work for you, go back to your family doctor. So that and the fact that in the early 80s, I branched out into learning something about nutrition, something about physical activity, something about, well, I was involved in psychotherapy, so I was pretty aware of how psychological factors affect people's health. But I became involved with a group called the Association of Complementary and Integrative Physicians of BC, based out of Victoria. And I was the president for a couple of years, and we put on three large-scale conferences at UVic there, which were very well received. We could have gone on doing more, but the effort of doing it exhausted the other members of the group, and so they kind of backed away from it. And I wasn't going to insist upon it from here in Salmon Arm, so the group actually pretty much has folded. But that side of my practice, looking at other kinds of remedial approaches like, you know, acupuncture, like herbal medicine, like nutritional supplements where appropriate, has been something that I can claim a certain amount of understanding of. And because it's not taught, nutrition is not taught to medical students at all. Certainly nutritional extracts like vitamins and minerals and other compounds, physicians really don't have a clue about any of that. They just think they lump them all together as one unit, which is sort of like taking all the drugs for heart disease and saying they're all the same, which doctors would get upset if you said that, because they're not, and neither are nutritional remedies of one sort or another. So there's a little learning curve that I think needs to be undertaken by the profession as a whole in order to understand that this gap in their understanding is very problematic, especially nutritional, basic nutritional unawareness. And then, of course, I was one of the founders of a group called the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, which has some members here. Three of my colleagues belong to the same organization. But I was one of the founders, and it's just having its 30th anniversary now. And there's an event next Thursday celebrating the 30th anniversary that I'm quite involved in. And that's a group that's looked at how our relationship with the ecosystem and the ecosystem's state of affairs affects our human health, which is increasingly relevant because we've contaminated the ecosystem with all sorts of chemicals that do things that we don't think are good, but we still spew them out. And the ecosystem is declining and deteriorating in a number of ways because of this and because of other things we're doing, like burning a lot of fossil fuels. And then, of course, dumping plastic into the ecosystem as if it was going out of style. It's become so common now, and the amount of plastic being dumped has escalated dramatically over the last 20 years. And it's almost on an exponential increase. So we're creating some problems, some health problems for humans and other creatures that live on the planet, both plants and animals, that a group like CAPE tries to, Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, tries to address directly. And we're having more impact now than we used to, but the problems are getting worse as well. So something, we really need to start doing some drastic things to change our ways, because our behavior is wreaking increasing havoc on the Earth's systems. And it's going to make the life for future generations a very challenging one.
With your profession in your office, have you noticed a change in the amount of patients that you dealt with before the pandemic as opposed to after?
Not really. No, I would say no. I mean, I worked in a clinic, as I mentioned, that was specifically for people who were worried about whether they had COVID or not. So I did that was extra. But as far as my practice was concerned, most of the interventions that were brought up to deal with the pandemic were done in other places and usually done by publicly funded clinics, staffed by nurses who were paid to do that work. I spent a lot of time explaining things to people because there was a lot of tension in a lot of people's minds. Some saying, you know, the remedies are draconian and they're interfering with their lives and we're really upset about that. And some of the measures were. Some of the measures with regard to schools and theaters and things like that were probably a bit overdone. But everybody was anxious, including the people in public health. And other people complaining that or worried that the pandemic was going to keep on progressing and getting worse and there would be horrible outcomes. And a more balanced approach, I think, was probably certainly the one that I tried to adopt, where I said, yes, I think the vaccines can be helpful, but it's not the only thing you can do to protect yourself. And wearing masks is another thing that you can do, but it's not necessarily the only thing. Probably not getting together in very large groups and breathing and sneezing and coughing on one another was a good idea. And then probably looking after your own personal lifestyle, making sure that you live a healthy lifestyle. If you're a smoker, this is a good time to quit. If you're a heavy drinker, ditto. It's a little harder to do that for some people. But, you know, overall, it's well known that a healthy lifestyle, eating sensibly, low in the food chain, probably organic as much as possible, getting regular physical exercise, managing the anxieties in your brain sensibly and in a balanced way, and also using community supports, reaching out to the community as a whole, working with your community, your neighborhood, to try and think of constructive and healthy ways to live your lives. Just such a thing as not using chemical pesticides on your lawn, spraying them on your lawn, because you're going to be absorbing some of them into your bodies, no matter how careful you are. It's a small thing, but if you add all the small things up, you get a big result. And persuading people that that's valid is sometimes a time-consuming project, but it's worth pursuing. And so I spend an awful lot of time in my office trying to explain things to people. And the pandemic just added another wrinkle to that, but it didn't really change all that much, I think. I guess I just couldn't bring myself to believe that this is the end of the world. And the other thing that happened is a lot of people came in and said, do you know the drug industry is making a lot of money out of this pandemic? I said, yes, they've been doing that for about, 50, 60 years. And you just discovered it and it's all brand new to you, but it's nothing new. And now you're concerned about it. But for the previous 50 years, you weren't because you didn't think it mattered. And I had one person who was very concerned about what was going on with the pandemic and said, you know, I'm really concerned. This is terrible. You know, look what the industry is doing. And they said, well, what were you doing 40 years ago? And they said, well, now you mention it, I was out partying. I was just having a good time. So while I was fussing about these things a long time ago, a lot of people are just kind of sleepwalking through their lives, I suppose, or through their days. Anyway, it didn't change much for me. And one of the reasons is that we're not market dependent. Physicians are in a very, very privileged position in society and in this country, in that we are paid directly out of the public purse. And we're often paid early on out of the public purse. We're not the last people to get paid. And that's something that's different from every other profession, lawyers, engineers, any kinds of high-level employees, teachers, for example, are much more susceptible to being told what to do, being downsized, being moved, being transferred, etc. We have tremendous assurity that our income will remain no matter what happens. As I point out to people, if something goes wrong in a remedy we recommend, we get paid to fix it. Whereas if you're a lawyer and something goes wrong and you make a mistake or there's a mistake made somewhere or an outcome just doesn't work out the way your client wants it to, then your client might get pretty obstreperous and say, I don't want to pay you any money. With us, we don't have to go through that step. The money comes from the purse that everybody contributes to with their taxes. So we have this enormous security, and therefore, if there's a big to-do in the community, it doesn't really have much of an impact on physicians and our livelihoods. So, and because a lot of people are concerned about livelihoods, if they don't have a big impact, then who's worried? I think if you're attuned to the community, and I've endeavored to be over the years, I am quite involved in a lot of things in the community, you see the impact on ordinary folk much more. And that's where I've seen changes. I've seen the changes in people's lives and lots of other changes as well, like a reduction in the social safety net. It's become impoverished over the years. And that's been really hard on a lot of people, people who have lived on social assistance, people who are elderly and live on a pension. Their lives have got worse. And I think that's troubling. And it's also bad for their health. And they probably come to see doctors like me more often because the negative effects on their health, whether it's anxiety, whether it's inability to avail themselves of quality food, quality possessions, or whatever it is. I think it's not a good thing. The social safety net plays an enormously important role in people's health. And we're now understanding that more and more. And so I'm a great fan of the universal basic income because it's a leveling way. It's a way of leveling income so that the super rich become a little less super rich and the impoverished and really marginalized become able to become meaningful citizens in the community. So stuff like that matters to me.
Are you currently accepting new patients?
No. One of the things that happened about, I guess, 7 or 8 years ago now was that I realized, of course, that I'm now 78, and I realized that my retirement was closer than it was when I was 45. So I realized that in order to have a smooth transition, I really should stop taking on new patients, because up till then, I'd taken anybody who walked in the door. And so that's been something that's off the table. It's been a big challenge for me after, you know, 35 years of accepting anyone who came in and often getting people who were not considered acceptable to colleagues because they had complicated situations or they just wanted to ask too many questions. I did my questions and so said, come on in, I'll do my best to answer them and take a little more time if necessary to do so. So I think I acquired a few more complicated patients than maybe typical. So as I've not been taking new patients, the ones a lot have drifted away, I guess. I don't see them the way I used to. But there's still a lot out there, and I'm working hard on trying to find a place to have their records and continuity for their care maintained. Because it's one thing if you're 25 and you don't think you need any help because you're living a fairly healthy way and you're not doing anything crazy and you've got a good job and you're happy in your life, etc. You don't need a lot of medical care. But when you're 70 and organ systems are starting to fall apart, you feel more vulnerable. You feel like it'd be nice to have somebody in your corner. And that's where family physicians are supposed to be. But with all these trends like short visits and one problem per visit and unavailability out of regular office hours, that continuity pattern has been interrupted. And that I find troubling. And so I'm looking for some place where, you know, patients I know who have complicated health problems can find a place they can get adequate care. I mean, some of my colleagues in town are terrific. They're like that. They go the extra mile for people and they think carefully about what they do. But not all physicians are like that. Some are more matter of fact and, you know, they do their job within the limits, but they don't go outside the limits that much. One thing about belonging to a lot of nonprofits is you uncouple earnings from actions, which is a very useful thing for everybody, you know, to do stuff because you think it's the right thing to do. I think it's a very good way to live because when you go to bed at night, you feel a sense of satisfaction about what you've done. So it's a great cure for burnout.
What's in your future?
I call it slithering towards retirement. And in that process, I have my irons in a number of fires that are, you know, community related, environmentally oriented, social justice issues, bringing forward indigenous perspectives on human behavior so that we can start smartening up a little bit and being less consumption and self-indulgence oriented as individuals within a society that encourages that. There's lots of things that I would do more of. I mean, I have a radio show at the station here, and expanding that somehow would be an interesting thing to do, but I still have a lot of paperwork I have to do in the office, so I'm kind of holding off on a few things, waiting for a few changes to take place.
just as a side here, I know that you have late nights because of paperwork.
No, it's because that's a time when it's quiet and you can think. And if you have some project that you're putting some creative effort into, it's sometimes easier to do. I mean, sometimes it's my daily doctorly work that keeps me up. But most of the time, it's something, some project or other that is going on and I want to work on it. The other thing is that when you've worked in medicine for a long time, you come to understand that day and night are not always the relevant divisions of your life. Sometimes night you're very busy and day you're not so busy. So I think it trains you to be able to start and stop more readily out of regular hours. If you practice it, I think the way it's meant to be practiced, it forces you to do that. I was on call for emergency one 24-hour period every week for, 30-odd years. And then on call for patients in the hospital if need be. So you value your sleep. You just don't keep it in the same package every day, every 24-hour period.
We can't not touch on this. Many people today won't know about this because it took place many years ago, but Shagra, you were the voice of a talking horse.
I was the voice of Shagra the talking horse. Yeah, Shagra was a small Arabian stallion owned by one of my patients who discovered when she was off work for a long period of time with some health issues that she could use hand signals to elicit behavior on Shagra's part, such as flapping his lips, such as opening his mouth wide and then opening him out really wide. And she trained him to do all sorts of things like pick up the phone and then flap his lips into the phone, looking like he was talking. She was looking for somebody who could verbalize what Shagra's lips seemed to be doing. And eventually she accepted me, although she always said my voice was too deep. He should have a higher voice up here. Which I thought was silly. People think of a horse as a big thing, not a little thing, and they think of deeper voices with big animals. But anyway, we had that little discussion over and over again over the years. Never came to much. But I was involved with a recording of Old MacDonald that went off with Shagra to America's Funniest Home Videos and end up winning one of their seasonal shows. And then there was a follow-up and... It was interesting. Shagra went all the way to the Letterman show in New York, across the country, which was very hard on the horse because it's a long way to travel in a horse trailer. But and other things. We did other things. We did some recordings and this and that and went to the high school once. And it was a complete flop because the buzz from the speakers completely threw Shagra off. Mm. And he ended up evacuating his bowels in front of 300 not pleased high school kids. You could hear a sound like, ooh, going through the entire building. But the poor horse was just absolutely freaked out. And it was very, very hard on Shagra. Mm. And we didn't know at the time what it was, but it became clear afterwards. And took him to the fall fair a couple of times. And I would sneak around and hide. And when Shagra was supposed to be saying something, I would have a microphone that would... The speaker was near where Shagra was, so we'd do that kind of thing. And then one day Shagra got the bloats. You get an intestinal obstruction, and despite some heroic efforts to resolve it, he died, I think, about 25 years of age, which I think for a horse is a decent age, but not an old age. And a few years later, Shagra's owner died as well from a complicated medical situation. And that was that. That was the end of my career as an invisible star.
There are still videos on YouTube, though, correct?
Oh, yeah. There's videos on YouTube. There's videos on YouTube, and the CTV station in Kelowna, for about 5 years, it seems to me, would play that segment of America's Funniest Home Videos over and over again, every 6 months, 3 to 6 months. And people would come in and say, oh, you were just down in California at America's Funniest Home Videos, and I see Shagra won this prize. And I said, yes, 3 years ago. But you'll be hearing about it again, no doubt. So, yes.
Well, it's kind of an interesting claim to fame.
Yeah, it is. And it was fun to be involved in something like that, to see why you don't want to be involved with television, because it took us the whole day to do a half-hour show. And that was because the audience was in, they had to get them to look right, they had to get them to respond properly to...
Bob Saget.
Bob Saget, yes. He was the host, and he was only there for part of the time because there was a guy who was quite funny. He was a sort of comedian who was there to keep us jollied up, and they fed us this gorgeous gourmet meal for lunch because we were there from the morning till the afternoon, late in the afternoon. And then they would, at that time, they would run the rushes, as they call them, the early, you know, the initial film over to a studio that was like halfway across Los Angeles. And the studio there would, the executives there would decide what they wanted to keep in and what they wanted to throw out. And then they'd send it back and it would be re-edited and sent back to make sure it was okay. And that went on apparently all night long. So it would, not only was it an event that a half-hour show took a whole day to shoot, it also took a whole night to edit. And I wouldn't have... I don't mind going out because somebody's in pain and suffering, but going out to edit a show so that somebody can laugh more or less the next day, not my sense of values, particularly. So anyway, that was the end of my career in television.
So Warren, is there anything else that you would like to... let the community know about yourself?
Well, I think they should know maybe that that having been a physician has been a very rewarding thing for me to do. I've certainly met a lot of really interesting people. I've had an opportunity to be helpful to quite a few of them. And I'm sure that for others, I haven't been helpful. It hasn't been the right thing for them, but I was able to at least give it my best shot. And I think that's something that a lot of people would like to say about what they've done in their lives. They'd like to be able to say, well, I did something that wasn't just something that put money in my pocket. It was also something that when I look back on it, I could say, I think I was in a position where I could try to do something good. You never know whether how good it is or isn't, but at least you felt you couldn't say I was just being trivial or frivolous or doing something very superficial. You can say, I was trying to bring something positive to people's lives. I think the other thing is that physicians need in the 21st century to become more engaged with the community as a whole, because we're now aware of the fact that a lot of healing takes place because the community is a healthy community. It's not just because individuals are healthy within it. And so we need to make it easy in a community like this for people to do things that are constructive, that are healthy, you know, physical activity, eating healthy food, finding ways to reduce their stress through community-based activities. All of those kinds of things are really, really important and probably as important as anything else that we as physicians do when people are ill. We patch them up when they're ill. And that's valuable. But what keeps them from getting ill or helps to keep them being well is what goes on in their daily lives within the community as a whole. So I think we need to be more attuned to those kinds of things.
Thanks for coming in, Warren.